This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. It's been 20 years since a mass shooting at Columbine High School shocked the nation.
I can say that this is a place of community and love and health and joy. And when I finished high school, it didn't necessarily feel that way.
Since then, school districts across the country have been trying to figure out how to best protect their students, with tougher security and through preventative measures, like better mental health services. We'll take a deeper look at how things have changed.
When you come upon a piece of public art, it may look very different depending on if the subject is male or female. We'll meet a Colorado artist who wants to change that.
And our film critic Howie Moshevitz reviews Peterloo.
But first, Governor Jared Polis has signed a bill giving local governments more control over oil and gas drilling operations. Senate Bill 181 lets cities increase setbacks and issue fines for spills and other violations. It also makes health and safety the top priority for the state board regulating the industry. Polis struck a conciliatory tone as he signed the bill.
The conflict that has led to back and forward oil and gas initiatives, great uncertainty and political risk for the oil and gas industry and for our communities and for our families feeling unsafe or uncertain in their homes, should and will come to an end.
Republican lawmakers opposed the measure throughout the legislative process, saying it would drive the energy industry away and hurt the economy. Colorado ranks fifth nationally for crude oil production and sixth for natural gas.
12 Democrats are now hoping to challenge Republican Cory Gardner in the 2020 U.S. Senate race. Of the millions of dollars already flowing in, significant amounts have come from outside the state. KUNC's Michael DeJuana reports.
Cory Gardner raised a little more than $2 million in the first 3 months of this year, an aggressive step for an election that's more than a year and a half away. About two-thirds of Gardner's contributions come from donors outside Colorado. That's according to filings with the Federal Election Commission, and a trend similar to the next biggest fundraiser, Democrat Mike Johnston, who raised $1.8 million. About half of his donations came from out-of-state donors. Andrew Romanoff brought in more than $500,000 for the quarter. Most of that money was from donors in the state. This is an early snapshot of candidates who have a jumpstart on fundraising ahead of what is expected to be an expensive Senate race. Michael DeJuana, KUNC.
If you feel like it's getting more crowded in Colorado, you're not imagining things. New census data shows the state's population continues to grow, and there's no sign that's slowing down, especially along the Front Range.
Since 2010, Larimer, Arapahoe, and Adams counties have grown by about 15%. Denver has seen growth just under 20%, and Greeley has seen a 24% bump in its population, making it one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the country. The state demographer's office projects Northern Colorado's population to double by the year 2050.
But one of the biggest stories this week involves Columbine and hundreds of other Colorado schools that were shut down Wednesday over safety concerns. This month marks the 20th anniversary of the shooting at Columbine High School. Our Guns in America reporter Lee Patterson has been digging into the topic for months, and she joins us right now. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Erin.
Okay, we've known the anniversary is coming, and this week there was a dramatic twist. An 18-year-old high school student was found dead in an apparent suicide, a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Law enforcement say they discovered her body in the Mount Evans area. Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened?
Yeah, sure. And so all of this matters because this 18-year-old woman, Sol Pais, had made what the FBI considered to be credible threats to the Denver metro area. So Pais landed at Denver International Airport on Monday morning, I believe. Mm-hmm. Then she went and she bought a shotgun at a gun store in Littleton. Mm-hmm. The FBI division here in Denver was made aware of her presence and frantically began searching for her because of the threats that she had made online and also to other people, but also because they say she was infatuated with the Columbine High School shooting.
Right. And that obviously raised some pretty major red flags.
Yes, yes, of course. And so between the threats and the manhunt, hundreds, perhaps over 1,000 Front Range schools were closed this week, and ultimately law enforcement did discover Sol Pais's body.
Right. And all of this as the 20th anniversary of the shooting approached. And I'm sure that must have played into the decision to close all of these schools.
Yes, absolutely. Of course it did. And I think the incident this week is a really good illustration of why Columbine remains relevant 20 years later.
Right.
Threats have continued. School shootings have continued. Gun violence has continued. Now, Columbine, of course, was not the first school shooting. There had been others in a couple of the years leading up to the incident in Kentucky, Arkansas, Oregon. But for many people, especially here in Colorado, Columbine feels like the first one.
I know it does for me. I mean, it's hard to believe it's been 20 years. I didn't live in Colorado at the time, but I actually was working in news, and I remember hearing about it when it happened and just thinking, how could this be true? This cannot be real.
Right. Absolutely. And this is what I heard from so many people in my reporting saying effectively, I cannot believe that it's 20 years. I remember where I was when this happened.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I was in high school. Other people I spoke to in my reporting remember, you know, details like the trench coat mafia storyline that ultimately proved not to be relevant. Right. They remember the extensive media coverage. They remember, you know, Katie Couric coming to Colorado and right. interviewing the parents of one of the students who was killed.
Absolutely. Now, you know, we've been working on this project, Columbine Then and Now. What did you decide to focus on in your reporting? How did that come about?
Yeah, so I decided to focus on what's changed since Columbine. One of the issues that ended up coming up was violence prevention through mental health care. Mm. And on that topic, I talked with a woman named Noelle Sudano. She's a high school guidance counselor at Columbine High School, and she was also a student there 20 years ago.
Oh, wow. What are the odds?
Yes, yes.
Hmm. I remember someone said to me, there are kids in our school with guns, and I refused to believe it until I saw something on the news. It just seemed so completely impossible. You know, I think that's a representation of the general thinking at that time.
She says a lot has changed since then.
I do think that there's a lot more conversation about things to look for and red flags. Unfortunately, I think a lot of those things have been learned from what happened at Columbine.
So, Erin, many of the mental health programs that were actually put in place because of Columbine, you know, anonymous reporting, hotlines, bullying prevention, you know, that sort of thing. What I found was that many of these programs, aside from potentially stopping school shooters, really ended up affecting many, many other kids who are struggling with other issues completely unrelated to school shootings.
Right.
Self-harm, drug abuse, depression.
Well, I mean, that's kind of a silver lining, I guess, to come out of all of that.
Sure, it absolutely is. And that's why violence prevention through mental health services actually really matters in a broad way.
Yeah, absolutely. And how about guns? Did you look into how access to guns or gun policy has changed?
So I did some reporting on how gun policy has changed, and more specifically, how gun activism, how, you know, anti-gun violence prevention has changed over the years. I interviewed Tom Mauser, whose son was killed in the Columbine High School shooting. He's a well-known guy throughout the state. You may have heard his name before.
Right.
And Tom was saying that the energy around these issues has completely changed over 20 years, and that it's something that is so, so encouraging to him. I also talked to a young activist whose name is Tay Anderson. He's 20 years old. He lives in Denver. He's running for Denver School Board.
But when you say Parkland, or when you say Santa Fe High School or Columbine High School, those are names that you'll always remember. When people of color die, it's normal.
Gun violence, Tay says,
it happens everywhere, and we have to pay attention to it everywhere, because it's not just saying Chicago and white suburban areas. It's the United States of America that has a gun issue.
Huh. It's the United States of America that has a gun issue. Interesting. Now, about how many people die from gun violence every year?
So federal data shows that in 2017, nearly 40,000 people died from gunshot wounds. Now, school shootings, mass shootings make up a small percentage of the overall gun violence in the United States. But school districts are doing all sorts of things to prevent school shootings in their buildings. One example, of course, is how schools on the Front Range shut down this week because of this threat from Sol Pais, the young high school student from Miami. Another example includes certain districts across the country allowing teachers to concealed carry, to bring weapons on school grounds.
Yeah, and the idea of arming teachers can certainly be divisive. Lee, you looked into it for the series on what has changed since Columbine. Tell us more about what you found.
So a couple of months ago, I was listening to a hearing going on at the Colorado State House about a bill that would allow people to carry guns on school grounds. School safety is a big issue. It has been since Columbine. And these types of discussions are going on around the country. One of the first people to testify in favor of the bill was a guy named Evan Todd.
As the two murderers made their way into the school and into the library, I was the first one targeted as they fired.
He was shot. Shrapnel blew back into his face.
And they walked around murdering my classmates execution style with no one to stop them. It's been 20 years and a lot of things were different and a lot of things have changed. But one thing that has not changed is I do not believe we have seriously taken into consideration how we protect and defend our children in our schools.
A few weeks later, I drove out to meet Evan at his home near Denver. He asked me not to say where exactly he lives because he says that weird people sometimes contact him about Columbine. Internet threats, stuff like that. I meet Evan's two little chihuahuas and his son Hunter.
Hello. How old are you?
Just over a year.
Evan's home with him on Fridays.
Sleeps through the night, eats good. You know, he's not in a lot of trouble. He's pretty awesome.
Eventually, Evan puts the baby down for a nap so we can sit and talk.
20 years later, are your memories of the shooting at your school still sharp? Or are you starting to forget details?
I can see everything like it was yesterday. And I can still remember the feelings and the sounds and the smells. And
that day, 20 years ago, he was in the library with his friends, attempting to write a paper.
So yeah, we were in there, you know, joking around and throwing little wads of paper at each other, and you know,
you were being a teenager.
Yeah, we were 15 years old. So, and then just in an instant, it's hard to explain because you had this adrenaline, but then you had this helplessness.
There was an explosion, smoke, then pops of gunfire echoing through the hallways. A teacher came in and screamed for everybody to get down. Evan describes an adrenaline rush as panic set in around him.
I remember thinking, okay, the police have got to be coming. Someone with a gun has got to come in here, stop these guys, we're going to get out of here. And nothing. One of them kneeled down and put a gun to my head and said, why shouldn't we kill you? And so when they came up to me, I really thought, this is it. This is the end of my life.
The killers didn't pull the trigger. And that day, naturally, has really informed his thinking about safety and guns. After the incident, the first time he shot one, Evan said that the sound made his heart race. It brought back memories. He wondered if maybe access to guns was the problem. Evan decided, no, it was people, not guns, that were the problem, and that generally, when used responsibly, guns make people safer. Like teachers carrying guns in schools. Evan explains what he means by that.
We should not ever ask a teacher to carry a firearm. We should just not disarm the ones that want to. And likewise, I don't think we should have the gun-free zones. There's no reason a parent who, like myself, has my carry concealed weapons permit should be disarmed at the door when I go to pick up my child from class.
Currently, teachers or school staff in districts in 31 states can legally carry weapons in schools, according to a review of state laws and local news coverage by Guns in America. There aren't any federal standards. The Education Commission of the States, an organization that tracks education policy, says that it's not aware of any state that allows districts to require that their teachers carry a weapon. Evan believes a teacher with a gun can make a difference during a school shooting.
What actually stops these from happening? And in the world we live in, a firearm is one of those ways. A firearm would have saved lives at Columbine.
Evan Todd's story is just one story, one perspective, formed around a rare worst-case scenario. Carrie LaFollette is a Columbine survivor who's now a teacher in Wyoming. At a school board meeting last year, a local news outlet reported she said that if teachers had guns that day, quote, I cannot imagine how much worse that situation would have turned out. Evan and Carrie's perspectives matter because these experiences are what many parents all over the country are afraid of. And those fears are driving the decisions around arming teachers.
The truth is we are never going to be 100% perfect and have risk elimination in schools or anywhere else in our society.
This is Ken Trump.
No relation to the president.
He's worked in school safety for over 30 years, and he thinks allowing teachers to carry guns is a bad idea.
I personally support concealed carry and respect Second Amendment rights, but the issue here is not one of protecting yourself. You're talking about tasking teachers, support staff members, to perform a public safety function.
Trump puts this discussion in the context of police officers using firearms.
What is interesting to me is that we've spent, as a nation, the past 5 or 10 years increasingly being critical of law enforcement, and we've demanded more training, more scrutiny. And at the same time now, we were having a conversation where we say give somebody much less training compared to a police officer, put them in a school, and everything's going to be better.
There isn't much data out there to suggest whether or not arming teachers would make things better. But the FBI has looked at active shooter situations, analyzing 160 of these incidents between 2000 and 2013. Most of them ended before police arrived, many in 5 minutes or less. The majority of incidents ended in the shooter killing themselves or fleeing or just stopping shooting. Just 5 of these active shooter situations were stopped by an armed civilian or security guard. And there are risks to those armed individuals. There's a chance they could be killed by the shooter or by law enforcement. As for the everyday risks, guns could be left in a bathroom or stolen out of a car, discharged accidentally, or simply used in a dangerous way. I asked Evan Todd, the Columbine survivor, about these risks, that a teacher could be mistaken for an active shooter, for example.
You're absolutely right that it does happen, but it's so minuscule. It's so small.
For Evan, the potential benefits simply outweigh the potential risks.
This. Yeah, you love puffs, don't you?
Evan believed in allowing teachers to conceal carry before he became a dad, but recently he's become more focused, more passionate on the issue of safety, and his son has been a big part of it.
You know, because I'm thinking about his upbringing and his future, and now it's a whole new motivation for the future, if that makes sense.
No matter how you define a mass shooting, they account for less than 2% of gun deaths in the U.S. each year. Evan gets that.
Had I not gone through it, I don't know if I would have the same perspective. And that's the difficult part, you know, because I can see that side of it where people carry on because they know how rare and how safe their children are. But, you know, I've seen evil in this world. Ignoring it never does anything.
Lee Patterson, KUNC.
You'll find all the stories in our special series, Columbine Then and Now, at our website, KUNC.org.
If you're looking for a way to honor and remember those impacted by Columbine or other events, there are a few things going on this weekend, including a community vigil at the Columbine Memorial in Clement Park. It's happening at 7:30 p.m. April 19th.
And there's a remembrance ceremony Saturday, April 20th from 3 to 5 p.m. presented by Columbine families, current students, alumni, and staff, both current and former. That will also be held at Clement Park in Littleton.
Aaron, April is one of my favorite months in Colorado because it's so wild. Snow, sun, flowers starting to bloom, frost killing most of them, but some still standing strong.
I know, you really get it all. Let's not forget the wind,
oh, yeah.
Which if you're a sailor is pretty exciting.
Plus, there are so many events going on this month. Easter egg hunts, spring celebrations, and my favorite, National Parks Week. Here are some of the highlights. Saturday the 20th is National Junior Ranger Day, and it's also free entrance to parks around the country.
Awesome. Sunday the 21st is Military and Veterans Recognition Day, and Wednesday the 24th is something that they're just calling Wild Wednesday. I guess that's wildlife, wildflowers, your inner wild child. All of that is fair game.
Saturday the 27th is Bark Ranger Day for the park's dog employees.
Aw.
Sunday the 28th is Park RX Day to sit back and enjoy the outdoors, just what the doctor ordered.
I'm definitely looking forward to getting out and enjoying all our beautiful state has to offer.
Me too.
you.
Now let's shift gears from natural beauty to beauty that humans create.
If you go anywhere in Colorado, you're likely to come upon a piece of public art. And if it's representational of a man, it's often one from state history. But if it's a female, it's typically a generic woman. As KUNC's Stacey Nick reports, one Colorado artist is looking to change that.
If you've ever caught a performance at Denver's Ellie Calkins Opera House, you may or may not have noticed the giant statue in the lobby.
This is an awesome sculpture.
Denver painter Carrie McKenna is standing in front of a piece dedicated to dancer Maria Mosina, who performed with the Colorado Ballet for more than 20 years.
John DeAndrea makes sculptures that are very, very lifelike from the subjects that he works with. And so it looks exactly like them down to, like, fingerprints.
Mosina is gracefully perched high in the air, held up by her husband and dance partner, Igor Vicini. It's just one of many publicly commissioned artworks that can be found in the Denver Center for the Performing Arts Complex alone. But McKenna says it's still a rarity.
There are a lot of pieces of public art that have women in them, but they aren't specific women. So they're either allegorical or they are representative of a genre of women. So there's a really great statue in front of the Colorado History Museum that's about Colorado teachers, but it's not a specific person. So that's the direction we're headed, is to honor specific women.
That representation matters to McKenna. It's important, she says, to honor the impact women have had on the state and to educate people about their stories in a real and public way. So when she inherited the AZ Foundation from her parents in 2016, McKenna refocused their mission from education to the commissioning and creation of public artworks honoring specific Colorado women.
Colorado has a very strong history of very strong women.
As for choosing those strong women, McKenna says there's a deep well to draw from, thanks to the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame, which already has more than 160 inductees, like Helen Bonfils. Bonfils has already been the subject of many private artworks. Across the DCPA complex, in the theater that bears Bonfils' name, sits a striking portrait of the heiress with the Rocky Mountains in the backdrop. Suzanne Yeo, the DCPA's Director of Communications and Cultural Affairs, points out the painting is rumored to be haunted.
If you stare at it long enough, the clouds will move.
Bonfils was one of Denver's biggest philanthropists at the time, especially in the arts.
Helen Bonfils actually created the theater over on Colfax, which is now the Tattered Cover. It used to be the Bonfils Theater. It was actually opened in honor of her mother. She also founded the Bonfils Blood Bank.
McKenna says another contender is former CU Boulder basketball coach Seal Berry, noted as being the most winning coach at CU.
There's, you know, name recognition around the state, and also a kind of an already understood implication of her importance to sport in Colorado.
Since it's unknown exactly how many pieces of art currently honor Colorado women, McKenna says one of the first steps will be cataloging a complete list of all the public works already out there. She also hopes to use women artists to create the pieces as often as possible. Stacey Nick, KUNC.
The new film Peterloo has revived awareness of an 1819 event in England that's been long ignored but is still important in Britain. KUNC's Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says the filmmaker gets inside his characters like very few others.
British director Mike Lee builds his movies more than he writes them. He starts with one or two actors doing improvisations, and then works outward to bring in more actors improvising more characters. In one of his present-day pictures, an actor might say, "I take driving lessons," so another actor will be brought in to create a driving instructor. Lee might spend 6 months or more developing a film in this way, and he did that with his new film Peterloo, which is unlike such films as High Hopes, Secrets and Lies, or Happy Go Lucky, because it's based on an actual event, and it has 160 characters. It's a big film. In August of 1819, some 60,000 people gathered in St. Peter's Field in Manchester, England. They were farmers and mill workers, at a time when workers were badly abused in England, and they came from all over the towns and countryside to demonstrate for the right to vote. Only 2% of England's people had the vote at the time, and that 2% were not cheered to see so many people riled up over the issue. The protesters were peaceful and unarmed. They included many women and also children. They were attacked, first by what was called the yeomanry, something of a local militia, many of them drunk, and then by actual troops. By accounts, 18 were killed and about 500 wounded. The event was called the Peterloo Massacre because observers and participants considered the unprovoked slaughter a parody of the Great Battle of Waterloo only 4 years earlier when the British finally stopped Napoleon. In the short run, demonstrators were punished, some leaders put in jail. But in the longer run, more people got the vote and news reporting became important. The London Times covered the event well, and the massacre helped give birth to what was the Manchester Guardian for over 150 years and is now known simply as the Guardian newspaper. But Mike Lee's not interested in making a history text or, heaven forbid, a docudrama. He digs into what the people may have been like, not as ornamental figurines, but as human beings driven by their needs, their hopes, their resentments and jealousies, their disappointments, and by their sheer humanity. The main speaker, a labor radical named Henry Hunt, Rory Kinnear, is demanding and self-important. He arrives in Manchester to learn that he will not speak for another couple of days. He worries, and he's probably right, that his stay in a public hotel will become known and will put him in danger. So he demands a private house. And when one of the organizers brings him home, it's to a wife not delighted to have an unexpected house guest, especially one who has many urgent needs for his comfort. Peterloo's full of unexpected characters and situations, meetings of women arguing politics and strategy to support the men, articulate political discussions among thoroughly uneducated people who refer to political tracts and classics of literature. Much of the conversation in the film is far more subtle and informed than a lot of what we hear now in our loud debates. And it's obvious that Mike Lee is not just making a film about an event from 200 years ago, about a critical moment in the history and development of democracy in Britain. Peterloo's about now, when people are cynical about the vote, something that might make the Peterloo demonstrators turn in their graves. Lee said that the English Brexit vote came while he and his crew were preparing Peterloo, and that those events only convinced him that it was the right time for a movie about voting and the vital responsibilities of citizenship. Lee also knows that Peterloo is not just about Britain. Other places in the English-speaking world are also struggling over profound questions of democracy. For KUNC, I'm Howie Moshevitz.
One last thing to leave you with before we get out of here. Saturday is April 20th, also known to marijuana enthusiasts as 420. And in honor of that, a Colorado Carl's Jr. has plans to test a double-decker cheeseburger infused with cannabis. But don't get your hopes too high.
I see what you did there. The Rocky Mountain High Cheeseburger Delight comes with a sauce infused with CBD or cannabidiol, which is actually a non-psychoactive derivative of hemp that some laud as a pain reliever. The burger will also come stacked with crisp cut fries and pickled jalapenos. It's priced at, wait for it, $4.20.
These jokes just write themselves.
They really do.
It'll be available at just one location in North Denver. This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members.
If you enjoy listening and you're not yet a member, don't worry. You can make a tax-deductible gift to support our work anytime at KUNC.org. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital.
And special thanks to Guns in America's A.C. Valdez, who edited Lee Patterson's stories for Columbine Then and Now. And thanks to KUNC operations manager Ryan Thompson for providing engineering and other support.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana. Other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode.
You can subscribe at KUNC.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. And tune into Colorado Edition Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.